Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Marianne Kenny, good afternoon. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
So Marianne, you're an academic, but you've written a memoir. It's called The Episode, and it's a story really, I suppose, about how life can spin completely out of control very quickly. And I would alert people that this conversation will touch on the challenging aspects of mental illness, so listener discretion is advised. So Marianne, I suppose the good news is that, as someone said to you at your lowest point in this, an episode has a beginning, a middle, and crucially an end, and we'll get to the end, but maybe we'll start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit first about your husband John.
Okay, so John was 10 years older than me. We were together for 15 years. He was from the UK. He was English, although he identified as Welsh. His family was from Wales, okay. His father's family. He, I suppose, had a very British sense of the ridiculous, of the absurd. We spent a lot of time laughing about the absurdities of life here and in the UK. We shared a lot of interests in languages, the outdoors, books, and of course, our love for our children when they came along. John became a stay-at-home dad, and I went out to work and supported us.
So life was good.
Life was perfect, I really think. We had moved into an area where we'd always wanted to live, and we had our little family and our nice house, and it just felt finally we had all our ducks in a row. Yeah.
So then just about 10 years ago, April 21st, 2015, and like all these days, started out as an ordinary day. Mm-hmm. What was your first inkling you got that something bad had happened?
Well, I was at work and I had just come out of a meeting at work, and I glanced at my phone and there were 6 missed calls on that phone. And I mean, 10 years ago, I didn't get phone calls on my mobile phone. Not really. I used it for text messaging. So I started to investigate, to try and figure out who was trying to contact me. And I ended up, after a couple of attempts, then calling John's phone. And it was answered by a guard who said to me, "You need to come to St. Michael's Hospital in Dunleary. Something has happened to John. You need to bring somebody with you." And I asked him to tell me what's happened to John. And he's just repeated. He said, "You need to come to St. Michael's Hospital, bring somebody with you." And I knew immediately. I just knew immediately that he was dead, because the guard wouldn't tell me over the phone. So I turned to a colleague and I said, "Something's happened to John. I think he's dead." And he was dead.
So massive shock.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely out of the blue.
He was out jogging?
Yeah, he was out jogging. He was a very fit. He was 60, you know, but there was absolutely no inkling or sign that there was anything wrong with him. He, as it turned out, had severe cardiovascular disease, but we knew nothing about that. And he literally dropped dead from one moment to the next. Yeah.
So a sudden death, everybody knows in some way the shock of that.
Yeah.
And then you also have to tell your children.
Yeah, indeed.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for a long time, I wasn't able to talk about that without bursting into tears. But I suppose I've got used to, I mean, I wrote about it. I'm able to say what happened. I picked my children up from a neighbour. I wanted to bring them home. And my older son was expecting his dad, and he kept asking me, "Where's dad? Where's dad?" And I said, I'll tell you when we get back to the house. And then he stopped and he said, "Is he dead?" And I said, "He is." And that was it. And we were just stood in the middle of the road. The three of us, just shattered. Our whole lives were shattered.
That's it.
Okay.
So now people should file that moment aside for the time being.
Yeah.
And that will come back. Okay. So you had the funeral you wanted for John, as you put it, and it sounds like a lovely funeral, music carefully curated, friends played and sang. And ritual kind of often carries us through those days. And then you write something so simple and so powerful in the book. You say, "Then the funeral was over and everything stopped."
Indeed, everything stopped. I mean, It was like my life was on ice, you know. All the people had gone. I wasn't working because I work as an academic and the academic year was over. I just felt immobilised. I tried to keep everything going for the children. The children went back to school after a certain amount of time, and I just sat in my home looking over my back garden, waiting for them to come home. I mean, that's what it felt like. That's what it feels like. I did actually do a lot in terms of busyness, papers, probate, solicitors, but everything stopped. All my hobbies, I stopped. Running, walking, jogging, anything I had done for pleasure, I just became completely immobilised, yeah, and sat on that chair and waited for my children to come home from school. That's my memory of it. Yeah.
And look, that's grief. It hit you hard, but given the circumstances and everything, probably a very normal level of grief. One of the things you did that's kind of so sad, really, you retraced John's final journey one of the days.
Well, I did that all the time. I mean, he had died half a mile from our home. So I was able to reconstruct with the help of people who had found him on the road. I was able to reconstruct where he had died, exactly the spot. And I suppose I would just do that little pilgrimage for myself, walk up there, try and imagine what he'd been thinking and seeing and listening to. And I would just, pick some flowers by the roadside and put them there for him. Yeah.
So, look, you had great support from family and friends, but one aspect of the grief that weighed heavily on you was your responsibility to your children. Can you explain that and why it became such a focus?
Yeah, well, I did have good support. I had friends who helped in any way they could think of helping me. But the fact of the matter was I was very alone, and that was for reasons to do with John was an only child and both his parents had already passed away because, I mean, he was that bit older. And my own family, for reasons of Irish emigration that we're all familiar with, all live abroad. All of my siblings had emigrated as long ago as the 1970s and 1980s. So, and then the only immediate family I had, apart from my children, was my mother, who was 90, who was a great support. But, I mean, she had reached a time in her life when, up to me suffering this tragedy, I was in the supporting role for her. So regardless of the efforts that people made around me, I was just desperately alone in my grief and in my responsibility for my children. I mean, I felt, and I think rightly so, that I had all the responsibility for everything to do with their current life and future happiness, that it really all came down to me. And it kind of did. It's actually a fact.
I
was just terribly burdened by it and terribly burdened by the children's suffering. I just found it unbearable to see them suffering. It just broke my heart.
Yeah, I bet. You went for therapy and I think that was a good experience.
So I did. I mean, I'd never been for therapy before. I asked around. I was recommended a local therapist. And I think in many ways, I mean, I only went to him once a week for an hour. But for that hour, it's almost like he filled a bit of that gap that maybe other people, if I'd had that close family around me, it was very much a case of practical help, just getting me through just the tasks that I had to fulfil and to be able to see a positive future. It wasn't so much grief therapy. I mean, I don't think you go for grief therapy that soon, but it was very much a practical help, and I found it very useful. But it was only just 1 hour a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So look, this is where things get a bit complicated.
Yeah.
I think the phrase you use is you grieved too hard. But look, like, your grief does not seem abnormal. Grief is something we have to go through.
Yeah.
And grief does look like depression in some ways.
Yeah.
So was it when you were put on antidepressants that you started to spiral?
Yes, I would say that. I mean, definitely I was before that. I mean, I was finding it hard. I was finding it hard to function. I was very sad. But in retrospect, we're only talking 2 to 3 months after the bereavement. I mean, that's a very short amount of time. And I do think that that was normal grieving, you know, brutal as it was. But yeah. A few people suggested to me that it might be helpful for me to try an antidepressant. I mean, it was at a time when I was very anxious about a lot of things. I was very anxious about the future. I was very anxious for my children. And then I was also very anxious about the prospect of trying an antidepressant. I'd never tried one before. I'd never been on any type of psychiatric drugs. And I suppose it's true to say I reluctantly decided that maybe it's worth trying. I mean, even my doctor was saying to me, this is normal grief, but if you feel it would help, I suppose we could try it. So I took an antidepressant in a very anxious state, and I was very anxious about the effect that it might have on me. And unfortunately, I suffered a very severe physical reaction. I suffered this burning and prickling and tingling throughout my body that was very, very intense, and that went on for a few weeks even after I stopped the drug. So I did have a severe reaction. I can't say if that was physical, if it was psychosomatic, if it was due to the anxiety, but it was an intense adverse reaction that I have to say drove me to despair and hopelessness for the first time, because I sought help for that. And I felt that the medics weren't hearing me when I said it's a physical reaction. They said to me, it's a psychiatric problem. We need to change your medication. We need to give you more medication.
And so that's the point where you started, call it mistrusting authority, maybe getting a bit paranoid about these people. It was then, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's true to say that my situation was in reality very precarious. So I mean, even before I had been finding it hard to function, but now I could barely function. I mean, all my energy was reduced into looking after the children, just making sure they were fed, that they were clothed. And I started to worry that somebody's going to say I'm not fit to look after them. And in that context, I did start to mistrust. The principal contacted me just to see how we were getting on over the summer. And I thought she might have an ulterior motive. I thought people were starting to question my ability to parent. But it was actually founded in reality, if you like. But my mind was getting ahead of myself for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So you developed a very specific delusion then,
I did.
Which is that your children had been harmed by your medication and somehow you were responsible.
Yeah. So this was at the heart, I suppose, of my breakdown. I became very suddenly possessed of a conviction that my children had been harmed by my medication and that it was my fault. And looking at that now, looking at that conviction now, I can see where it came from. It had elements. The elements of that conviction were all the worries that had consumed me up to that point. So concern for my children's well-being after the loss of their father, and my terror really around taking psychiatric drugs and the effect that they had on me. And it all got confused and jumbled up in my mind. And also, of course, that feeling that I'd had irrationally, definitely, that the children's suffering had been my fault when their father died. All of these worries that had consumed me for a number of months since the bereavement, they all got jumbled up into this fierce conviction that took hold of me. Something has happened to the children. It has to do with my medication and it's my fault. I did something. I must have done something. Yeah, a delusion of guilt relating to the past tense. Something has happened. I didn't believe I was currently harming them. I didn't believe I had no intentions or plans to harm them. But that something had happened in the last few weeks.
This was very real for you.
It was terrifyingly real and it was all consuming. I could think of nothing else. I have ruined my children's lives. I've ruined, and it was specific as well, I've ruined their brains. I've ruined their mental capacity. You know, it's funny because those were things I was worried about after their father died, about their mental health. And yeah. Now I've ruined it. I have. But it's my fault.
I presume everyone around you, like you were saying there, you thought people were questioning your parenting, which they weren't at that point.
But yeah.
Was everyone around you telling you, you haven't harmed your
children? But I mean, I wasn't sharing this with a lot of people because I was mortified. But I did start to share it with the professionals because I wanted to unburden this terrible guilt that I believed. So I wasn't telling my friends or my family because I was mortified, if you understand.
So I can imagine the pressure of that as well, of holding that in.
Yeah.
Was it almost a relief initially when you were admitted to a psychiatric
hospital? It was a relief. I mean, I felt terribly guilty for leaving my children. I just thought, now that they've lost their father, now they've lost their mother, I felt terrible about that. But I also, I was relieved. I just thought, because I was at rock bottom, I handed myself over to the care of other people.
So after that initial experience, then I'm more interested in talking about the second time you were admitted to hospital, right?
Yes.
And this was for a more extended period.
Yeah.
And tell me about the day you left the hospital and how things kind of unraveled from there.
Okay. So I spent a total of 12 weeks in hospital in the second half of 2015. And a week after my second admission, so the first admission was just 2 weeks, and then I was readmitted a few weeks later. And when I was readmitted, I was in an even worse state, if that's possible, than the first time around. And at this stage, childcare arrangements had become a real challenge. It was very unclear who was going to mind my children while I was in hospital. My mother was there as a constant presence. But the whole issue, the whole possibility that they might be taken into care had become a possibility, at least a real possibility, not just something in my mind. And after I was re-hospitalised, I spent the first week back terrified about this possibility, and at the same time struggling with my delusional guilt. So it was my delusional guilt and real life worry. And I left the hospital. It was a spur of the moment decision. I went home to check on the children. I'm not saying that was a sensible thing to do, but it also wasn't something that I planned to do. I just simply drifted out of the hospital. I went home, I checked on the kids. I didn't actually meet them, but I was able to talk to them on the phone. I was brought back into hospital. I came back voluntarily and I arrived back to hospital that evening.
Okay. I suppose assessments continue.
Yeah.
And things are there. I think there's a little bit more of an element of crisis management with people at this stage.
Yeah.
And you did something you immediately regretted, I know.
Yeah.
But in the course of these assessments, you made, I suppose, what would you call it, a false confession
about
having an intention to harm your children?
Yeah. So while I was being treated, a big component of that was to assess me and to ask me. Now, I was asked multiple times a day whether I had thoughts of harm. And when they asked me, did I have thoughts of harm, it was very clear that they were future focus. So do you have any plans? Do you have any intention to harm yourself, to harm anybody else? I had been asked that, I would say, consistently for 2 months. And it seemed to intensify after that first week when I was back in hospital. And each time I answered truthfully that I didn't have thoughts of harm, the types of thoughts of harm that they were referring to. But I did believe that I had harmed my children in the past. I was trying to, you know, distinguish. And after I left the hospital, I mean, I can only imagine what the professionals thought I was going to do when I was outside the hospital. You know, the worst possible, I'm sure, scenario for them. That questioning intensified and continued. And what happened was I effectively threw in the towel. I said to them, you're right, I'm wrong. I didn't say those words, but that was the gist of it. Yes, I've had thoughts of harm. Yes, I intended this. Yes, all your worst fears about me are true. I'm just the worst possible person. That was the message I was giving. So I confessed to thoughts of harm that I never had. And it was just a spectacular act of self-sabotage and made my life a million times worse.
Yeah, and you understand, yeah. I know, how once you say something like that, it sets off all kinds of alarm
absolutely.
Bells.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally understand that I was covered in red flags at that point, if not before. Effectively, then that became the truth of, for them, that I harboured the worst types of thoughts, and that, in fact, I had always harboured those thoughts, none of which was true.
The strange thing about it then is, so you were more heavily medicated after that. But the strange thing is, the drugs did work. The fog started to lift after a while.
Maybe it's not strange. I mean, these drugs are designed to work, and eventually they did work. Now, they didn't work for a long time. I would say I'd been taking medication for 2 months before it reached that peak, that I would say that weekend when I made that false confession.
Yeah.
But my drugs were being changed and adjusted, and I know I had come on to a different antipsychotic shortly before that. Perhaps it was that particular drug, I just can't say. They kind of zombify you, and maybe when you're suffering in the way I was, from such a self-destructive belief, maybe that's exactly what you need. You need to be turned into a zombie.
Yeah.
And whether it was that, whether it was the passage of time, but very soon after I made that false confession, and I would say in a matter of days almost, I started to come to my senses. And the big thing for me was realising that my delusional belief was just that. And it took a few weeks. You know, I describe it in the book as a gradual process of me coming to the realisation, oh my God, that never happened. And now you've really created a conundrum for yourself with the stuff that you said. But I mean, I was severely ill at that time, you know, and I spent my time trying to unravel the whole thing.
And then meanwhile, life is going on outside the hospital. You missed a lot of things. Mm. Birthdays, started the school year, Halloween.
Yeah.
You did emerge then out into the blinking lights of Christmas in December 2015. What's it like then coming back out?
Well, like, the amazing thing in all of this is that I recovered. I recovered almost as quickly as I became ill. So I got better when I was in hospital. I mean, I can't say that it was a pleasant experience for me. There were lots of things that traumatized me in different ways when I was in hospital. But I did recover. I came back to my senses. Firstly, I became energized. I felt more energy than I had felt since before John died. And I emerged, and it was, like you say, emerging out into the sunshine, blinking and feeling stunned, devastated by what had happened to me over the previous 8 months since John's death. But overjoyed. I was out. I was free. I had my mental health back. I had my physical. Well, it took a while more. There was some physical issues that had to be resolved. But I was back home. I was with my children. I went back to work. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing. I went back to work within, you know, early January. And very soon I was back working full time on medication, still on medication, but I had adjusted. I think I had adjusted, but just I was better. It's just extraordinary. I was overjoyed.
Yeah, because I imagine when you're lost, it's very hard to think that you will ever find your way again.
Yeah.
So look, I think you wrote the book and it's an attempt to make sense of what happened there. And there are various things that people would take from it. Well, one thing, did you get much talk therapy while you were going through the psychiatric system?
Well, I mean, that is something that I talk about in the book and make very clear that there was no talk therapy. So while I was in hospital, one of the most counterintuitive, I suppose, aspects of the whole experience is that I was never asked to talk about the day my husband died. I was never asked to talk about the moment when I told my children that he was dead, which now...
And we go back to that moment again.
So no is the answer.
You believe that moment
was
the moment that began this...
I do, because when I think about how I felt when I was in the grip of that delusional belief that I had harmed my children, I felt exactly the same the moment I had to tell them that their father was dead. I thought at that moment, subconsciously, I'm shattering their lives.
Yeah.
It's the same feeling.
So come here, irrationality can be very rational too. It has its own kind of scheme to it, doesn't it?
Yes.
So that's one thing that you never got to talk about, the very simple things that were certainly at the root of your sadness at the time. And for you, the psychiatric system, potentially not the best system designed to help someone who was in distress like you, do you think?
Well, look, unfortunately, I suffered three traumas in 2015. And the worst trauma of all was my experience of psychiatric treatment. It's completely what I feel. And it was for that trauma that I needed later to get therapy and multiple approaches with different therapists until I found a trauma therapist who really helped me.
And also, I think why you wrote a book that attempted to understand the system that was there. I suppose, you know, Tony Bates comes in here sometimes and he talks about that a lot of the time what people need if they go into psychiatric care or whatever. They need to be held. They need to be heard.
Yeah.
They need to feel there's a human being there with them, treating them like a human being.
Exactly.
And no fault to anyone involved here, but this system is not always set up like that or doesn't work.
So, I mean, that's exactly what I feel. I mean, I learned recently the word patient. It comes, the root of that word, it's the same root as we have in words like pathos and sympathetic. It means suffering. Comes from the same word. I was just fascinated to read that. I was a suffering, distressed human being who had lost my greatest ally in life. And I found myself in a system that didn't sit with me in my pain. And it's just very sad.
And look, lots of people will have different
kinds of
experiences as well. And you are saying that you did get cured while you were in there, which
is
fantastic.
And I'm saying it's my experience.
But your experience of the system was that. You know, people can think of ending up in a psychiatric hospital that it's a thing that happens to other people, or it's a thing that happens to people who have always had a history of dysfunction or mental illness or whatever. Part of what I thought was very powerful about the book is that our lives and our grip on reality, as I was saying at the start, it can spiral out of control so quickly, can't it?
Yeah, look, I think we need to be a bit more humble, perhaps, you know, in our beliefs about what we can control in our lives.
Yeah.
And also more compassionate and more understanding that this is something that could happen really to anyone. But I also want to hold out hope that if it does happen, and if you're lucky enough, as I was,
you can recover if
you find safety after that trauma. And it's incredible the resilience that and strength you can find within yourself, or that I was able to.
And how are you doing now? Did the whole experience change how you live your life?
Well, I always lived my life in the moment. I was always very appreciative of what I had. It made me stronger. I mean, it might sound like a cliche, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but really made me stronger. And I think one of the main reasons for that is I found it within myself to recover. And it's really strange, but I feel much stronger today and I am very happy. And of course, publishing this book just closes the circle for me as well, because I am really happy to be able to share this with other people and to hope that other people can learn from my experience and my ability to write about something as just traumatic and often stigmatized and secretive as this. So I feel very happy today.
Yeah. The book is really interesting. It's really powerful. You know what it is too, though? It's desperately sad.
It's very sad,
isn't it?
At its heart is a very sad story about, you know, everybody wanted the same thing, wanted me to get better. The professions wanted me to get better, I'm sure. But just how there was that clash between my needs and the system I found myself in. And just, it is very sad. Yeah.
You must feel sad for yourself.
I do. I feel a lot of self-compassion, which I think probably shines through as well. I feel a lot of compassion for that person that I was. Yeah.
I bet you do.
Yeah.
Okay, Mary Ann Kenny, thank you very much. The episode is the book and it's published by Penguin Sandy Cove. Thanks, Mary Ann.
Thanks, Brendan.